America, from the deserts to the sea, from the mountains to the snow, you are tuned in to the Johnny Punish Show, produced by the Veterans Today Network and BTN Radio, brought to you by HireVeterans.com, America's job board for U.S. veterans. Let's get this show rockin'!
I spent all my years fighting for a place in the sun.
And I hit all right, I'm on with Ayman Hutka. He is U.S. Army, retired, and he is a Middle East expert. He served in the Gulf War in the early 90s, and he also served in the recent Iraq War in a very significant way. I will not tell you exactly what he did, but I can tell you that what he did in both wars was meaningful to the United States of America, and he's one of our greatest American heroes. But I'm going to let him explain what he did during the war, and then after we discuss that with him, we are going to talk about the future of the Middle East, because he lives both in the United States and in Jordan, and he has extensive experience in the Middle East. He's one of the legitimate experts that we have in the United States. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ayman Hutka to the show. Tell us about your role with the United States military and your role in the Middle East.
I was a U.S. Army soldier. Reference to my relationship with the Middle East and the U.S. Army. I served in the first Gulf War. I worked in the 3rd MP Group, CID. I was part of the Criminal Intelligence Section for Protective Services. You know, you're part of a team. A lot of times people are singled out for different things, for different achievements. But in reality, people wear medals, but but they really represent a group of people, because rarely do you have a person achieving really great things on his own. You know, when you're part of a great team, they make you, and I was always fortunate enough to serve in 82nd Airborne Division with great guys. I served with CID, Civil Affairs, as well as Special Forces Group, you know, and the level of readiness, the professionalism, the motivation, just really brilliant.
Right, right. Let me ask you, in terms of the first Gulf War, you were in Baghdad, is that correct?
No. The first Gulf War, we never went into Baghdad.
Okay.
The first Gulf War, Kuwait. So we launched out of Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Although I wasn't in a combat role, because I was assigned to a different type of unit. Due to my language abilities, I was recruited by CID to work criminal intelligence. I ran sources.
You speak fluent Arabic, is that correct?
Absolutely. Being an Arabic speaker gave me an advantage. And, you know, you don't need an Arabic speaker in the front line, although that's what I was trained to do. You need an Arabic speaker to really work the back end stuff. And from whether be it intelligence, be it administrative, liaisoning or whatever, you know, they get a better bang for their buck by assigning you to do something like that.
Now, in your role in the Iraq War, obviously, you were in the military for 15, 20 years?
I got altogether 17 and a half years active duty, 22 years altogether. Because I was part of the reserve is a funny component, because you have to have so many good years, per se, you know. I was always going off, working overseas, breaking away from my reserve time, going into the IRR, it's called Inactive Radio Reserve. So, you know, because of that, I didn't really quite make my 20 years. At 17 and a half is where I broke it for retirement purposes.
Gotcha. You know, so, now, you're being very modest. Now, what I'm going to say right now is important. I want listeners to listen to this. Very important. You have, well, your personal friend was Saddam Hussein. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't say my friend. He was...
He wasn't your personal friend?
No.
Okay. He was, but you didn't know him.
I was, again, being an Arabic speaker, yeah, I can joke of it. I always said, I like to think it was my blue eyes or charming personality that got me these great assignments. But in reality, it's my Arabic language. And I was picked up by a special missions unit during the Iraqi war recently in 2003, and I worked in their intelligence section. So I was part of a great organization, and truly great. I mean, when it comes to great, this is a great organization.
Right.
Well put together, well selected. Every guy was, you know, hand-picked for that job.
Gotcha. You know? Would you like to share with us and our listeners any information about Saddam that you know, since you've actually can I say you spoke with him?
Yeah, of course. I was his first interrogator for the first 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then I walked away and I wanted to go out doing my manhunting mission versus some people would love to be able to make that a career. And it is a career. You know, you're the guy who worked Saddam, okay? To me, okay, you know, that's fine and dandy. That's not what I look for, you know. I seen the FBI guy. I seen the other people that went in there after me.
Let me get this straight. On 60 Minutes, the FBI took credit for interrogating Saddam Hussein. But what you're saying is it was the U.S. Army, not the FBI, that did it first.
Well, let me put it, go further than this. The capture and the initial interrogation of Saddam Hussein was done purely by a U.S. Army unit. Okay, the capture, let me even go back further. The development of the intelligence, the capture, and the interrogation of Saddam was done by Delta Force and Delta Force only. The CIA, the FBI, none of the security services of any country played a single role in that capture. It was purely that unit. Okay, and that's pretty significant.
Yes, I'm glad you've clarified that, because we all get different accounts of what happened, but we have the evidence that you were actually with Saddam, and we have that visually, of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, you and I go back a long way. I trust you with my life, and I gave you and showed you documents and pictures and all that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't really share that very much. I'm a little bit shy about it, talking about it.
Welcome
enough
America.
Time passed to
Welcome.
Where... You know, we could talk about it.
Saddam don't serve, always hamburger mama.
you're Muslim, and how do you reconcile these issues? Because right now in the United States, we have a certain faction of the extremist wing of the U.S. has got a lot of Islamophobia problems. And if they find out that, you know, a person who was of Muslim faith was actually one of America's greatest heroes and did an amazing service more than most any American can do for the United States of America, it doesn't reconcile with their narrative. How do you work through that?
Well, I ignore it, and I fight it. I fight it by the best way to fight, if you want to call it ignorance or terrorism or whatever, because some of them cross the line and want to terrorize the Muslim community in America. You know,
right.
I would say this to all of them: if you're so hardcore and hard bent on fighting extremists, give me a call. I will take you to the nearest recruiting office, and I will make sure you get into a unit that is fighting these terrorists. Okay, come on out and be an all-American, man. Don't sit there and do exactly what these terrorists are doing to other civilians living in America peacefully and being productive. Okay,
wow.
That's a cowardly act, and I don't address cowards. I don't deal with cowards. And I don't deal with ignorant people. You know, ignoring them is the best way to defeat them. You know, I can't debate them because they go and they go to these hate-filled sites, seminars, and some unfortunately churches that promote the hate. You know, and they orchestrate and they educate them so well. I can't even debate them. You know, and I know my religion so well, you know, better than all of them, but I can't debate them because they're just, you know, they bombard you with all kinds of, you know, innuendos, misinterpretations or bad interpretations or, you know, on purpose, badly interpreted to suit their philosophy. So yeah, to me, I just look at them and call them the Christian Taliban. And what do you do with them? You either ignore them or you fight them, you know, because we're a law-abiding civil society here. You know, I work with the law. You know, I allow the FBI, I allow the local police departments, and they do a great job, you know, and I always consider the law enforcement agencies, you know, at all levels in America as my friends, you know, and I rely on them to protect me. You know, having said that, you know, if anyone crosses the line, he'll pay dearly. You know, it'll be a fatal mistake because, you know, my family will be protected at any cost.
Of course, absolutely. And no one would expect anything less. Okay, so let's move on. I'm glad you addressed that issue, and you couldn't have said it better. I've never heard that before. Go to the recruiting office, Americans. If you got a problem, go fight the extremists and stop being an extremist yourself.
Absolutely.
You couldn't have said it better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely.
You know, okay, I mean...
And you know what? You're being a coward by allowing others to go fight while you're sitting here blabbering and running your mouth, you know, and really not doing anything, any real action.
Well, Ayman, let me ask you this, because you have on-the-ground experience more than 99% of the people I know. I want to ask you about the current situation in the Middle East and then ask you what do you think the future can be or what will be. First of all, this week we had the deputy foreign minister of Israel say outwardly and in public that Israel is for Jews only and that land is theirs, only theirs, and nobody else. How do you reconcile that? What do you think about that?
You want me to address ignorance? It's ignorance and it's hate. What can I say about that?
Well, this is a person who's in the government. This is not a person who's living on the street.
I'm going to address the Deputy Prime Minister of Israel and the Foreign Minister, what's his name, Maniac. I go to Israel often enough. I got relationships with security companies in Tel Aviv. I go there and I consider them friends. And I drive from Jordan. I cross the river. I go into Israel. I go to Jerusalem. I go to Tel Aviv. I go to Kafr Kama. I go to up north, south. I go to Haifa. You know, Beautiful country, well manicured, and I give him credit for that, you know. Mm-hmm. But, and I'll tell you something, the masses of Israel don't agree with that ignorant line, okay? Jews that want to, God-fearing Jews that just want to live in peace and raise their children and prosper like every other man and woman that have children in the world, to include Muslims, they don't agree with that, you know. And so you got to understand politicians. When they blabber their mouth like that, when they run their mouth like that, all they're trying to do is gain popularity, gain something. It's for a gain. Push comes to shove, okay? And they go into the international arena, and they're dealing with the Americans and the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese and you know, the world community. They change their tone because they know they can't go out and sell that bullshit, you know? Mm-hmm. Excuse my French, but I just can't address it any nicer, mm-hmm. okay? So that's why you got to ignore these people, you know, and just look back and see what is going on in his life and or his political career. Is there is he maneuvering so he's like, you know, pandering to a certain voting block, you know, inside Israel, you know, because that's all domestic stuff.
Right. Well, within Israel, we have over 20% of the population is non-Jewish. So what is she saying? I mean, imagine a politician in the United States going around saying, by the way, the United States is only for white Christians and the rest of you get the hell out of here.
Well, they are saying that during the President George W. Bush, you know, you had politicians coming out and, you know, saying it directly or indirectly, pretty much the same thing. But that's not America. That's not Americans. Americans are way more smarter. They're more sophisticated. They're more hospitable. They're kind. They represent a small segment. In an era, they took advantage of the 9/11 incident, which is tragic, you know, and started spewing hate. A lot of people didn't stand in their way because we're going to war. Anyone who stands against what we're saying is, you know, with the enemy. So they rode the wave kind of thing. But now you have guys who would sell out America for his own benefit, like Ted Cruz. You know, and the soup party. What's the word it called? Soup?
I don't know.
What's his party?
His party? Ted Cruz is a Republican, like almost a Tea Party guy, isn't he?
Tea. Oh, I thought it was soup. I'm sorry. That's one on me. Okay. I've been out.
Did you go to comedian school or did you go to paratrooper school?
Paratrooper, we laugh at ignorant people. That's how I fight Ted Cruz, you know. Seinfeld, the soup Nazi.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, you know, that's how they are.
Yeah. Well, I think Ted Cruz is not stupid. I think he's pandering to xenophobia and trying to get advantage but I don't think he's a dummy. I think he knows what he's doing.
Let me tell you something. I think he is a dummy because, and I think he's very anti-American.
Right.
Right now, when President Obama, you know, you like him or not, you got to stand with America. And that's what I'm all about. I'm standing with America. Mm-hmm. If a Republican comes in and he's doing the right thing for America, I'm all about supporting him.
Agreed.
If a Democrat comes in and he's doing the right thing for America, I'm all about supporting him. Because you know what? That's what I am. I'm an American. And mm-hmm. that's what I want to support. Now, I'm not going to sit there and damage the country, its reputation, for party purposes.
Right.
When I'm more loyal to a party than my own country, that's treason in my book. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when Ted Cruz held the budget and downgraded the U.S. standing with the Standard & Poor's and global standing financially, he hurt America for what? To make a name for yourself? To me, that's very un-American. That's treason.
I agree. You know? It's We're in a very tough situation with these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't like guys like him that sacrifice our reputation, our good name, so he could make a name for himself to run for president. Why don't you go out there and really do something good for the American citizens, for the poor people, for the rich people as well? You know, they're Americans as well, and they deserve to have certain advantages. They create jobs. By God, give them advantages. I don't mind, okay? Mm-hmm. Because able to pour, you know? So why don't we come up with a balancing thing? Everybody fought Obama, you know, and previously President Clinton about the health care. You know what? I just came back and brought my family back here because my children started school age, so I wanted them to be educated in the U.S. Let me tell you something. The insurance system here sucks. It's inhumane, okay? That's the best way to describe it. It's not quite criminal, but it's very inhumane.
And you say that because you've traveled all over the world. You know, you've seen everything.
Of course. Look at Europe. I'm not going to go to a third world country and say, look at their medical system. Look at Europe and look at their medical service. It's second to none. They afford you education. They afford you medical. They take your taxes. They take taxes from me, but give me a decent living, okay? Give me a decent, my daughter broke her arm doing gymnastics. Mm-hmm. We got like dollars worth of bills, okay? My insurance covered the bulk of it, and I paid a good number of it, okay? And we're still paying. I just paid off the last thing. And the way they come at you, the way they bill you, the way they exude, it's just so inflated. It's a broken arm. You know, in the old days, you know, they'd go to war, they'd break an arm, they'd work in the field, they'd break an arm. And the guy who takes care of the cow would take care of your bone as well, you know. People lived and moved on. Nowadays, you know, it's just criminal to pay $40,000 for 2 days worth of treatment. 2 days.
Wow.
I could go to a 7-star hotel, take the presidential suite, and not pay that much for the same amount of time. When I'm talking about, I could pay $5,000 and take a presidential suite at some of the fancy hotels in Europe and or Dubai, for example, and not pay that kind of money. And believe me, you don't even know what pampering is until you try one of these suites.
Well, that makes you very angry, obviously. I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah, it does. It does. Now, I'm very fortunate that I'm able to cover everything, and I had good insurance. I paid high premiums to have very good insurance. God forbid, these poor folks, you know, the hardworking Americans, something happens like that to them. What happens to their children? What happens?
That's a part of the economy that we're all struggling with.
You know, it makes me feel guilty that I'm able to afford that. I work hard and I earn it, and I want that privilege. But you know what? Why should I only have that privilege and the well-to-do? And the rest of them, what happens to that child?
Right. You care about your community, the Republican Party and the Tea Party. It's basically fend for yourself or go screw yourself. They don't actually care about community. They just care about themselves. That's what it's about.
I don't want to target them. I want to target any politician.
That's who's saying it. I mean, I'm not anti-Republican or Democrat. I'm just saying that's their argument. They don't want insurance for everybody. It's like fend for yourself. If you can afford it, great. If you can't, die in the street.
The first vote I ever voted for was Reagan. I'm a Reagan Republican.
Okay? Hey, did you admit that?
Absolutely. Proudly. Are you kidding? Proudly. But the guy loved America. Okay? Nothing is perfect. No one's going to come in and just move, you know, the magic wand and make things. But he worked. He tried, you know. There was a Soviet Union, life dynamics. There was wars in Central America. There was this and that. But he went out there and did his best. And, you know, and he brought humor to the job. He brought humor and made us feel good about being Americans. Okay. Ever since then, until Clinton came around, you know, and did what he did, you know, brought humor back to the White House, you know.
Are you saying George Bush the first wasn't funny?
You know what? I hated Clinton. Let me tell you something. I hated Clinton. I mean, I hated him. I hated the fact that I was serving under a guy like Clinton, who never served, smoked pot, blah, 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 blah. You know what? As I grow up and I look at things and my perspective is changing on what is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. I think judged fairly, he could go down one of the greatest presidents in the history of America.
Wow, that's a big difference in wisdom.
Let me tell you something. Oh, absolutely. Okay, because I started loving my country the right way. So now I don't look at party lines, I look at America. And who did good? The guy handed over George W. Bush, President George W. Bush, okay, a surplus. When did we have a surplus in the last 45, 50 years?
Right.
Okay, that's damn good management. That guy cared about the country. He worked hard for the country. He wanted to get a blowjob? By all means, he deserved one.
Especially if his wife doesn't care. It didn't seem like she cared much.
Hey.
Who knows? We don't know people's relationships.
You know what? Yeah. And I'm not taking what he did lightly. You know?
No, neither am I.
The office of the president deserves certain stature and respect and all that. You know? It does. And it really represents us, all of us. That office represents every single American.
Agreed. Okay?
So it deserves better. I agree. And I say, but in reality, it's... The guy did a wonderful job.
He sure did. Well, I mean, let me transition this forward because we actually want to talk to you about the Middle East because you are an expert in that area. Tell me about what's going on now in the Middle East. You have ISIS. You have the wars in Yemen. You have Israel continuing its occupation. There's a lot of Syria, of course. There's a lot of things going on in Iraq. Where is it now and where are we going? Are we still in the Sykes-Picot 100-year World War I Middle East, or are we transitioning to something different?
Well, Sykes-Picot never went away. It's still in effect. Just look at, go back and research the Arab Spring, and then as trouble flares in certain regions and or countries, look at the Western powers who took the lead. And then based on that, go back and, look at the division and or the agreement of Sykes-Picot, and that would tell you it's still in effect till today. Okay? So what that tells you is that's part of the big problem is, when you and I have a conflict or a disagreement about something, we sit down and we talk about it. And we have to come in with open minds and hearts and really look for a solution to find a solution. When you have the Western powers, with that mentality of, colonial powers, okay, still, then you're always going to have problems. Okay. You're going to have friction. You're going to have that. If you remember working for people, the boss talking to the employee.
Mm-hmm.
Syndrome, that's one. Two, our intelligence agencies supporting revolutions, okay, and helping install all the wrong people. I seen it in a movie once. The guy comes in and says, "Oh, hey, John, let me introduce you to Bill. Bill owns steel industries. And meet Bob. Bob owns railroad." This guy owns aircraft manufacturing, and this guy's into this. So I look over at John and say, "Hey, John, all these guys own everything, and you don't own, I don't know you own a single factory." He goes, "Oh, I don't need to, I own them." So in essence, you don't need to put your money in all these infrastructure. What you do is you buy the head of the infrastructure, okay? And thus you control it by default, okay? So that's the policy the Western powers are taking with the Arabs, by installing stooges, yes men, collaborators, and the Arab masses know this, they know it because politically they're fairly smart and fairly intelligent, and they know a stooge when they see a stooge, like the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen, Mm-hmm.
Abu Abbas.
When he negotiates with Israel, it just tells you he's a stooge. Why would I go back and sit down when the guy just told you you're an idiot? I ain't giving you nothing, okay? but why don't we talk about to recognize me, recognize my right to every piece of the inch of the land, sign that, and then we'll keep talking about it for the next 10 years, Well, and he signs it. That's the problem. So what does that tell you? He's a stooge. He's handpicked for the job to fail. So you got problems like that, And then, of course, the influence of the IMF, the World Bank, and the debt, you know, all these countries owe so much money, you know, and by default, they're subservient to the World Bank. And the World Bank and the IMF, we know who owns them, okay? So by default, you're owed. Every single citizen in the Middle East works for the IMF and the World Bank by default.
Wow.
When really, I mean, those two instruments are colonial instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to go to them. You have to go to them. And you have to take loans, infrastructure loans, and you have to have debt. If you don't, you'll have political problems. Okay, so they want to ensure that they control you, and I hope I don't sound like I'm a conspiracy theorist. I hope I'm not.
Because you don't sound like one at all.
What's that?
No, not at all. You're telling it like it is, the truth. That's what we want to hear on VT Radio. We want to hear the truth. We don't want to hear the nonsense. We want to hear it direct. You're the man on the ground. Tell us what's going on.
Having said all this, you know, if a simple little soldier like me could figure this out, you know. Imagine the much smarter guys, you know, the highly educated guys, the very analytical guys, you know, the guys with access, you know, were ministers before or studied economics, got a PhD in economics, got a PhD in whatever, political science, that really understand the dynamics of all this and could really eloquently put it in perspective. They know what's going on. And this is what's helping grow the crazies we see, the ISIS, the Al-Qaeda, other factions, you know, all over the place, growing and fighting, and they're just fighting. They just want to fight. I mean, I don't know what ISIS's objective is, you know, to have an Islamic State. Well, I'm a Muslim, and I got news for them. If you guys are in charge, I don't want to be a Muslim anymore. You know?
Of course.
And I'm very proud of
Muslim. And a lot of people feel that way, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, the masses feel that way. No one wants to go and be under psychos like them. They don't represent anything Islamic, zero, and that's a fact.
Now, you being on the ground in Jordan, obviously you've traveled to Iraq and other places as well. You've met these people on the other side. What are they like?
Well, I mean, I could safely say, you know, during the war, I talked to, you know, in the hundreds of Al-Qaeda guys. I interrogated a lot of them. And a lot of them are just decent guys, really are. You know, I don't want no one to misunderstand me thinking I'm defending anyone. There really are nice, decent guys that are just sick of what's going on, you know. And a lot of them got caught up doing a lot of wrong things. I could tell you this for a fact. Very few people know this. The guy goes, and all of a sudden, car blows up at a checkpoint or an entrance or whatever. People don't know, but a lot of times this guy doesn't know he's going to be a suicide bomber. They tell him, hey, go park that car over there. And they know, the handlers know for a fact he has to go through a checkpoint, or if he's going into a hotel parking lot, he has to go through the security checkpoint. And he goes there and he just wants to go through, and they remotely triggered a bomb. And oh, he's a martyr, you know, the guy gave his life in the name of Islam. I got newsflash. God forbids, period. There's no exception, suicide in Islam. Anyone, and he tells us, if you commit suicide, you're going to hell. There's no forgiveness. Don't kill yourself, okay? This is very, it's like, you know, one of the,
it's black and white in the Quran.
Yeah, absolutely. Very clear, crystal clear. So these people, you know, committing suicide, thinking they're going to go to paradise. Read the Quran, buddy, you know. But at the same time, a lot of the handlers, a lot of the criminal elements within these religious movements are really sending innocent guys driving cars here and there, and they're remotely triggering the bombs and killing other innocent guys doing their job securing the country, you know. So you have a lot of that, and people don't understand that, you know, and it's unfortunate because, oh, they say, oh, yeah, another suicide bomber, you know, and I'm sure the news media know, a lot of them know it, but they're not reporting it. I don't know why,
you know. Well, it fits the narrative, I guess.
What's that?
It fits the narrative that they're trying to speak to the public about. They don't actually, you know, they kind of twist it one way or the other to make sure it comes out the way they want people to hear it.
Well, one thing I learned, the media is very biased, okay? Very, very biased. You can look at the reporting from Israel. You can look at reporting in Afghanistan. You can look at a lot of reporting, you know. During the Cold War days in the 80s and the 70s, London was one of the most dangerous cities in the world, you know, with the IRA and the war with the Irish Republican Army and all that. But when you look at the tribal advisories, you'll never see any warnings for London, okay, because mm-hmm. it'll hurt their tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So the Western powers never declared that. And they allowed us to go and be exposed to danger in London and other cities, only to help their allies at our cost. So people don't know this, you know. And you go back to the 70s and the 80s and look at the threat level in London, you know, because of the war with the Irish Republican Army.
Of course.
And then you go to Jordan or you go to, you know, Egypt or whatever, you know, before this, the current mess that's going on. And you always travel advisory, you know, be careful. So a lot of tourist people don't go there. Jordan's right. A holy city, holy land, you know.
Right.
Jesus Christ was baptized over there, you know, on River Jordan. It's got unbelievable amount of historical and religious artifacts, you know, and buildings and things.
Mm-hmm.
And tourism is not that big.
Could be much better.
What's that?
If we had a safe region where people felt good about it, I think tourism would explode in that area.
Well, you know, I don't understand why we don't have a safe region. I blame all the Arabs and the Jews together. I mean, just
when you say Arabs and Jews, if I may just interject, what are we talking about here? Because there's Arab Jews, there's Arab Christians, Arab Muslims. There's
okay. Well,
for example, you're not an Arab. You're Circassian.
Right. What I'm talking about, Arabs and Jews. Jews by culture, not religion. Okay. Jews and if you, why don't we flip that? I'll go religiously. Muslims, Jews.
Okay. Christians. Jewish, Christians, and Muslims.
Are stupid for in reality. Imagine this: the Jews and their influence and their resources, their intelligence. With the Arab masses and the land and the water, blah, blah, all that combined together, put their minds, their money, their brains, their resources, their manpower, put it together, and you could really develop an economic powerhouse over there that would compete with the European Union and the North American NAFTA. Okay.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I know I've talked to you this before privately, and I will share this publicly on VT Radio. Is that my idea, as utopian as it may sound, as out there as it could be, is I want to plant a seed for the Middle East Union and make an example, for example, like the European Union. Previous to the 90s, or late 90s, excuse me, we had a Europe that was different money, different countries, very hard to get along with each other. Business was good, but it was disjointed. And when they made the Union, although it has issues, we're dealing with an economy of over half a billion people that rivals the United States now. So what we could have in the Middle East is what I propose is Middle East Union. In fact, you can see my ideas at MiddleEastUnionCongress.org. And my ideas was to create a union of liberty, freedom, and justice for all, freedom of religion, and anybody that commits a hate crime against any religion is a criminal. You're not allowed to hurt or commit violence on any level. That would be a tenet of the Constitution. So basically, it's based on the ideas of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington in our American Constitution. But make a union where we don't need passports. You can go live in Israel if you want. You can go live in Saudi Arabia. You can go live in Baghdad. Wherever you want to live, it's all the same passport. Now, I know that's far-fetched. It's out there. But that's what I think could be an amazing solution if we can get the world's leadership to understand the benefits of it instead of making money off perpetual war for Sykes-Picot nonsense that has no future. It's got a It's the past. It's a 20th century idea. It's not working in our connected world, Ayman. What do you think about my idea?
The Carlyle Group and Raytheon, what do you want them to do with their factories, okay?
They gotta retool, make solar panels.
Good luck. and reference to a union in the Middle East, unfortunately, what you're talking about when advocating is putting a lot of politicians out of business.
That's right.
And that's and you'd go to jail for advocating something like that, you know?
Well, that's why I'm advocating from another country. I'm not advocating from within.
Here's the problem with political systems, you know? They're all naive, without exception. Karl Marx, for example, communism, you know, I was a Cold War warrior, you know, I started out with during the Cold War, and I was ready to fight, and you know, and I, my dream was to do a parachute drop into the Red Square, you know, mm-hmm. in Moscow, but it didn't happen, unfortunately. But when you look at communism, you know, with Karl Marx theory, it's really a wonderful concept, you know, equality for humanity, blah blah blah, you know, mm-hmm. but what each political system, whether it's socialism, communism, capitalism, you know, all of them strive for one thing, one soul body controlling everything. So they're all really for the same objective. That's one. Two, problem is they're all naive, you know, these theories, because what they don't take into account is the human nature. And that's the problem right there. That's the core of the problem. We humans are the worst animals on the planet. Most animals go out and eat when they're hungry. They don't kill to kill. They kill to eat, you know. Some do it to mate, you know, because of their ritual. But for the most part, they coexist. We're the worst predators on the planet. And that's the problem why all these different political systems don't work really well. Capitalism, it's great, but it has a massive inhumane side to it, because it's sink or swim. There's no two ways about it. You're either out there, you're busting ass and you're making money, or you're on the road, you know, saying, hey, I'm a veteran, give me money, you know. And that's a tough system, you know. It has no humanity in it. It's all about making money. It's all about the stock market. It's all about showing profits. It's all about all that. That's all. That's how corporate America in the 50s and 40s was all about the family, you know, the corporate family. Today, it's all about the numbers, you know. They don't care about loyalty to their employees. You know, employees don't have any loyalty at all. And that's why, you know, we're running stagnant economy, you know, because the American consumer and the workforce isn't loyal to their employer as well, you know. And that's the problem. We got to resolve that. And you resolve that by having, you know, social programs. And I know a lot of the audience would hate what I'm saying. You know, I'm not a socialist. I'm not a communist.
Well, they try to paint everybody as a pure something. You're not. No one's a pure socialist. And no one's a pure communist. You can't be. It's not possible.
You know, I don't mind being a Republican and listening to a Democrat saying, hey, man, that's a great idea. Why don't we promote that? You know, I really don't mind that. I wouldn't fight him because he's only a Democrat. And that's what's going on here. You know, they're just fighting each other because of the lines they crossed, they drew, you know, in the Senate floor and the House of Representatives. And I hate seeing that, you know, very un-American what's going on in Washington. And the same thing goes on, you know, and that's what's allowing the growth of psychotic groups like ISIS, the Brotherhood. Very well these days, the Muslim Brotherhood, that is, Al Qaeda and other factions, you know, Islam, Nusra Islam, you know, and on and on and on and on, you know, it's just growing a lot of opportunities. The Gulf states, they're very wealthy. They invest in the West. They don't invest in the Middle East. You know, they got a ton of money. And they got poor people in their own countries, you know. So it's a very unfair situation what's going on.
And now, we have the same problem in, you know, Europe. World War II was completely destroyed. I mean, we're dealing with a situation where that Europe came back from the depths of a horrific war. Some would argue worse than what's going on in the Middle East. Can the Middle East come back?
Well, of course it can, provided you get the right people in the right place. You know, after World War II, when Germany was defeated, General Marshall, and as you ever, it's well known now, the Marshall Plan, you know, came in and brought in $3 trillion and rebuilt Europe. What they need to do is come in and bring in prosperity to the Middle East, improve education, improve health, improve, give opportunities. A lot of times I don't want to drive, so I take a cab. You know how many cab drivers are engineers and they're driving a cab to make a living? You know, you'd be shocked at the number. Engineers, business guys, you know, business degrees, architects, you know, civil engineers, electrical engineers, engineers in particular. You know, a lot of engineers in Jordan, and all of them, a lot of them are end up doing different odd jobs because they can't find work. You know.
Okay, so how do we change this paradigm in your point of view? What can we do to make the Middle East a great place for your children and the children of your children? What can we do?
One, what we have to do is mass communicate, smarter, get them to think the way ahead, steer them from the radical thought, okay, without deception, because you know they've had enough of that. Strategic communication, you know, from the media outlets, from the games, from different things, have exchange programs, bring the Americans here, the Europeans to the Middle East, send the Arab kids over there, let them get educated. And because you get about four or five generations now, you got to write them off. You know, they're disrupt, they're inadequate, so what we need to do is just build the seeds for the future in our children. You know?
Can we get a Marshall Plan for the Middle East?
Well, right now, no, because if you bring in an infusion of money, all you're going to do is squander that money. Okay, because you don't have good institutions that would safeguard and ensure the money goes to the right places. Okay, so corruption would overwhelm that. What you need to do is come in there and manage it yourself, or invest in the future generation and build for them. Don't build or do anything with the current ones. I would write them off. That's how. That may sound crazy, but that's a fact. The corruption is just rampant, out of control.
In every Arab country?
Without exception.
Wow, that's heavy.
Absolutely. And let me tell you something. Here in America, most Americans are very professional, very straightforward, very honest, the whole thing. You'd be shocked how corrupt they become in the Middle East. I guess they take that literally when they say, when you're in Rome, do as Romans do, you know? They go to the Middle East and they become part of that, you know? Mm-hmm. So from official people to business people. But a lot of times, you know, you come in, you know, if I come in and I'm negotiating with your company and you have a certain style of doing business, you know, or corruption or whatever, I'm not here to educate you to do a better way to do business, you know? So if this is what the way things are going, all right, so be it. Our government reserves a right to do whatever they want, and they're involved in corruption. They're involved. They break rules that apply to us all the time. But so companies come up with creative ways to really conduct business in the Middle East and other third world countries, for that matter. I mean, Africa's no better. Asia's no better. You know, one of the most corrupt countries in the world I've ever seen and dealt with is India. The level of corruption and creativity is just phenomenal. If they put that energy and really do something good, India might be a true superpower.
Yeah, no kidding. Very smart people there. I deal with a lot of people in Bangalore.
Bangalore is a great place.
The Silicon Valley of India. Okay, so Ayman, let me ask you another question. You're going to be going to the Middle East tomorrow. You're leaving from Texas tomorrow. You'll be in Jordan. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I understand you're taking your family for the summer.
Yep.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Tell me what the Middle East is going to be like for your children when they're adults. I'm talking about 20, 30 years from now. What are we looking at?
Well, to be honest with you, if I have anything, if I assess it based on what I see right now, I hope they're not there. I hope they're here in America. I'm not very optimistic. My hopes are things will be fixed and peace will prevail and stability, prosperity, you know. A lot of money in the Middle East, a lot of intelligent people in the Middle East. But as of now, it doesn't look very good. I'm not very optimistic.
So 30 years from now, do you think we're looking at massive civil wars? What are we looking at?
Potentially, yeah. Potentially. You might have, you know, it's very complex. You get the Arab-Israeli issue, okay? You have the Sunni-Shia issue, okay? That's not going to go away because all of them live there. If outside elements don't come in and be fair and honest brokers, okay, and really look for solutions between all these parties, it's not going to go away. And it's just going to get worse. The West and the Far East is dumping weapons in there, you know, and different people supporting different factions, and Russia as well, by the way, you know. So different people are supporting different factions. My analysis, for example, ISIS. ISIS is a Syrian intelligence, Russian intelligence, and Iranian intelligence controlled organization. Because when you look at their actions, you know, in northern Syria and the Anbar province in Iraq, the only people they hurt and attacked so far is really the Sunni populace. They're supposed to be a Sunni movement. They're supposed to be fighting the Assad regime, which is a Shia, a branch of Shia religion, you know. But they really haven't fought the Assad army, okay, or the Syrian official army. All they fought is the resistance and other factions fighting the Syrian army. That's all they fought in Syria. In Iraq, they went into the Anbar province and just committed a lot of atrocities and crimes against the Sunni population, took over Mosul, and went down to the gates of Baghdad and stopped. Well, that's where the Shia government is. If you're a Sunni and you're supposed to be fighting for the return of the Sunni control of Iraq and Syria and all that, what happened? You know, so what that tells you is they're really serving a different master. And that master has weakened all the opposition of the Iranian-supported Shia movements in Iraq and Syria, and of course in Yemen. But Yemen, Hezbollah is involved with that, and Iranians are involved with that directly.
What are you saying? It's the crazy place?
It's very crazy, very fluid, very dynamic. You really have to understand that, you know, and anything that happens, you look at the people that got hurt and the people that benefited. ISIS only helped the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, helped Iranians and their Shiite guys in Iraq, in Baghdad. Okay. That's all they did. They didn't hurt. They helped them because they weakened the others. I know for a fact now the Sunni tribes in the Anbar, Mosul region, and Kirkuk and other places, Bakuba and all that, they're organizing their own Sunni army brigade to fight ISIS, okay? Because the Iraqi army isn't really doing it. They're really not. Mm-hmm. You know, how long did it take them to liberate Tikrit?
Mm. Well, let me ask you a question about the Middle East then. If we're looking out forward 10, 20, 30 years, with all these factions and all these arms coming in from Russia, United States, etc., the West, is it just going to have to explode into out-out civil war like we have now and just keep going till it just cleans itself out? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, what is the definition of clean itself out?
Till they all kill each other.
Well, you're not. I mean, you know, because you're just the growth rate, the birth rate is high. Okay, so you're just going to have a generational thing, you know. You just got to put an end to it. You got to sit down and bring in fresh people, you know, to sit down and talk about peace.
Speaking of fresh people, let me ask you this. I know my children are connected. They are on Facebook and they are smartphoned. Is the people of the Middle East on smartphones today, or are they absent of connectivity?
No. They're that's a big part of what's going on in with all this thing is the internet, smartphones, the different applications for communication and all that. You know, Twitter, Viper, Tango, Skype. They're pretty savvy with that.
Okay, so here's what I'm thinking, Ayman. You talked about investing in the future and letting go of the 20th century crusties that still believe in some other ideologies. But what we should do then is invest with these young people. I'm talking 25 and under, possibly even younger than that, and invest in those people to get them connected. For example, I'd like to see your children and their children communicating with other Christians and Jews and Muslims and connecting. And when their parents talk about killing each other, it would be nice if those kids say, wait a second, mom and dad, thank you for that extremist point of view, but you're talking about killing my friend who I just talked to on Facebook 5 minutes ago. I'm not down with that. And that's what we're dealing with all over the world. It's not just happening in the Middle East. It's happening all over the world. Today, I was communicating with, like I told you, with people in India. And the girl in India tells me, hey, how's it going? Everything's cool over here. I'm like, cool? What language is that? Is that an Indian colloquialism? It's not. It's the language of the future. The internet is changing the world and the way we communicate. I think that is where we can find the new Middle East Union and some formation of that, where people don't look at themselves as Jordanian or Israeli or Iraqi, but as humans on this great planet. What do you think?
I couldn't agree with you more. Symbolism, you know, this flag concept, we got to get rid of, you know. A lot of us, you know, they raise a flag, we rally around the flag, and all of a sudden we die for the flag. It's a piece of rag, you know. Get over it. You know, you want to kill other human beings or hate others because of a piece of rag? That's ridiculous. Time to grow up. Other parents or children, but I'll talk about mine. For example, on this trip going down there, on my agenda is for me to take my family across the river and show them the Israel, you know, and let them meet Israeli kids,
right,
you know, and play with them.
Connect.
And all that. If they choose to fight that generation, they choose to fight, then that's their choice. That's their generation. It's their time. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give peace a chance. I fought in wars. I know what the ugliness of war is. Okay. So I'm the kind of guy that would go beyond the extra mile for peace and understanding. Okay. So I want to instill that and put that seed in my children.
Gotcha. Okay? On that note, I'm going to have to end it. We're at the end of our show. We're crossing the 1 hour conversation. I'd like to have you on again, if you don't mind. You have a lot to say about this issue and our listeners and our lovers.
Good day, America. From the deserts to the sea, from the mountains to the snow. This concludes today's Johnny Punish Show. Produced by the Veterans Today Network and BTN Radio. Brought to you by HireVeterans.com, America's job board for U.S. veterans. I'm your host, Johnny Punish, wishing you an amazing day. Until we meet again!